Hello, and welcome to
Killing It
on Broadway. I'm Jennifer Simard.
And I'm Jessica Vosk, and this is the podcast where we discuss all things guts, gore, murder, and mayhem.
It's not safe for work. Hi, Jess, I'll call.
Hi, Jennifer.
And hi, Betsy Wolf.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Welcome to the little podcast that could. You have joined us today from your quarantina. Where are you at these days, sis?
Right. Well, it's funny you should ask. No, right currently, I am in New Jersey, which I think
you know very well,
but I am heading back into the city soon.
Okay. Right. Well, enjoy your time out in the burbs, in the Jersey burbs.
Thank you. I have enjoyed my time out in the burbs. I'd never lived in Jersey before. I wanted to be one with Jess Vosk.
That's right. You're welcome to my state. You are welcome here.
Well, and I know you guys have worked together. Betsy, I think we've known each other for 15 years now. Hello. We're thrilled that you're here. You're a Broadway star extraordinaire. Betsy Wolf, ladies and gentlemen, she's here with us today. But Betsy, the thing about our show is even though you have this incredible, amazing, storied career, we don't want to talk about it in the least.
Oh, no. We should just spend the whole hour talking about it. It would take 5 minutes. No, I'm just kidding. I know.
Now talk about when you were born.
Jess, this is going to be my podcast.
Your first time on the boards. Tell us about that.
Yes.
Back in vaudeville.
In the circus. You know, but Betsy, even though we're not going to talk about that, we still have a great story today. And we think that you would be quite interested in it. But before we get into the story, which is Crickety Cray, I wanted to ask you, because our listeners love to hear this specific question answered from our guests, which is, why are you interested in true crime?
Oh, it is a great question. And yet I feel like it reveals like this kind of weird truth about each one of us, is that, I don't know, I am always fascinated with true crime, because I'm like, how? Why?
Is it the psychology
of
it?
Yes. Like, what makes someone do that? I don't know. I don't know if there's a cross between, like, the fact that I become an actress, and that ultimately, I guess, is like one of the main questions we always have to ask. But I think it's fascinating to me to just, I always think, like, what makes a person get to that point? I mean, I'm obsessed with it. In a weird way.
It's not welcome. Weird. We're going to start a support group when we can all sit in a circle again. Would you bring the donuts?
Yes, I will gladly bring. They're actually making a Krispy Kreme by me, so I consider it done.
Terrific. Oh, Jessica, carb queen. Here we
guess
go.
What?
Now, like our Ted Bundy case that we did recently, the case we're doing today also traverses several states, but these crimes did originate in California. And Betsy, from our understanding, you are from California. Is that correct?
I am from California. And there are so many serial killers from California.
We've had it's more guests from California than
freaky.
Any, I'm afraid.
Yeah,
I
what's
know.
In the water?
I don't know, and I don't necessarily want to claim that I know, but at the same time, it is really trippy when you think about how many cases are in California.
Well, here we go with today's case. But first, credit where credit is due. We got some of our information today from Wikipedia. Please donate to Wikipedia. Thanks, Wikipedia. This is the case of Rodney Alcala, a.k.a. the Dating Game Killer.
Oh, my God. This case, y'all. Okay.
I know. So, Rodney Alcala was born Rodrigo Jacques Alcala Bucquar in San Antonio, Texas, to Raul Alcala Bucquar and Annis Maria Gutierrez. In 1951, Alcala's father moved the family to Mexico, then abandoned them 3 years later. That's nice. In 1954, when Alcala was about 11 years old, his mother moved him and his two sisters to suburban Los Angeles. In 1961, at the age of 17, Alcala joined the United States Army and served as a clerk. In 1964, after what was described as a nervous breakdown, during which he went AWOL and hitchhiked from Fort Bragg to his mother's house. Hey, my dad served at Fort Bragg. Hey, Dad. He was diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder by a military psychiatrist and discharged medical grounds. Yes, ma'am.
Hi.
Dr. Vosk, ladies and gentlemen. Yes.
Thank you. What is that diagnosis? What is antisocial? What is it?
Antisocial personality disorder. This is Dr. Smart. Hey, guys. Hey. And by the way, Betsy, everyone here is a doctor when we have them on the show. So you are now Dr. Wolf.
Yes.
Use that as you will.
Absolutely.
Antisocial personality disorder, or ASPD, or infrequently APD, is a personality disorder characterized by a long-term pattern of disregard for or violation of the rights of others. A weak or non-existent conscience is often apparent, as well as a history of legal problems or impulsive and aggressive behavior.
Okay.
It's so much worse than it just sounds on the surface.
They have all kinds of risk factors. And what's that, Dr. Wolf?
Well, it just sounds like, you know, you say antisocial and let's just think like, oh, they don't like to go to parties. No, a violation of someone's like personal rights. It's a bit deeper than it sounds, you know?
That's like, I'm not going to throw a drink on you. I'm going to light you on fire. Like
an additional step.
It's the one more step of okay. Thank you. Moving on. Thank you.
You're so welcome. So he was discharged on these medical grounds. Other diagnoses later proposed by various psychiatric experts at his trials included narcissistic personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, and malignant narcissism with psychopathy and sexual sadism comorbidities. I wonder if he's eligible for the coronavirus vaccine.
Probably.
You know, it sounds like he's got a lot of issues that are immunocompromising his immunos to me.
After leaving the Army, Alcala graduated from the UCLA School of Fine Arts and later studied film under Roman Polanski at New York University. I know. Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. So here, let's go on to his early criminal history. So Alcala committed his first known crime in 1968. An eyewitness in Los Angeles called police after watching him lure an 8-year-old girl named Tally Shapiro into his Hollywood apartment. When police arrived, they kicked the door open and the girl was found alive. She'd been raped and beaten with a steel bar, but Alcala had fled. Isn't that horrible? To evade the resulting arrest warrant, Alcala left the state and enrolled in the NYU Film School using the name John Berger. And if you ladies would give me a moment.
Mm-hmm.
I picture him downtown near NYU at a diner, just like, I've got to come up with a new name. Let's see, John, as he's chomping on a cheeseburger. John Berger, that's brilliant. I mean, what a stupid name. John Berger.
Then I'm going to change the spelling so it's super creative, you know? Let's not spell it like a burger.
I know, right? He did like B-E-R-G-E-R, I think.
Exactly.
But then I think, as we're getting to next, in 1971 that summer, he obtained a counseling job at a New Hampshire arts camp for children, which, of course, I'm trying to hunt down, you guys, because, of course, that's where I'm from, New Hampshire. But what I read, y'all, is they said that when he went to this camp for children, he used a slightly different alias, which was John Berger, B-U-R-G-E-R, because that'll throw him off the scent. I don't know if that's true. That is what I read.
That's amazing. Yeah.
I don't like anybody anymore. I don't like anybody.
Normally
I would say he got that name from Sex and the City because of Berger, but this is far too early and Sex and the City hadn't been created yet and there was no Berger and yet here we are. Anyway.
Here we are. So we're splitting our time out here, you guys, between New York and New Hampshire. In June 1971, Cornelia Crilly, a 23-year-old TWA flight attendant, was found raped and strangled in her Manhattan apartment. Her murder remained unsolved until 2011.
Ooh, girl.
Can you imagine? Now, the FBI added Alcala to its list of 10 most wanted fugitives in early 1971. A few months later, two children attending the arts camp noticed his photo on an FBI poster at the post office.
This story's
Alcala
nuts.
What's that?
That part is nuts. They recognized him.
I know. Can you imagine? They go to the adults like, hey, we found this guy. And they all apparently
they liked him
very much. He was a fabulous camp counselor.
And they thought, no way. No way.
Yeah. Dr. Wolf, I see you've done your research. Thank you.
I love that. I told you I'm obsessed.
I love Betsy so much. You guys, we already know this because I love Betsy for 7,000 other reasons. But on top of it all, it's
a sickness. Keep going.
Not only do we share a sense of humor, which is humor in French, but we also have a like true love for this kind of shit. And I'm just so happy that you're here today. God bless. Go on.
But that's what makes this case so unique. That's why he had the audacity to go on. I feel like I'm ruining where Dr. Samar is talking. Nicknamed this name, the dating game killer, because he was so enamored with himself and he knew he would get away with it. He knew his charm would cover this all up that for that exact same reason, so many people were like, that's not him, even with composites back then. Remember? remember? You know, people just were like, that can't be him. That's why this case is so freaking fascinating to me.
Oh, agreed.
He was so brazen. Agreed.
Yeah. So Alcala was arrested and extradited to California. By then, Shapiro's parents had relocated their entire family to Mexico and refused to allow her to testify at Alcala's trial, which I completely understand. You know, I mean, to be re-traumatized, I get it. So unable to convict him of rape and attempted murder without their primary witness, prosecutors were forced to permit Alcala to plead guilty to a lesser charge of assault. This guy got away with it for so long. So Alcala was
paroled after— Because I think of that initial, like, mischarge, you know, because they couldn't charge him for what he fully should have been charged for. He was just, people just didn't think there's no way he could do what he did.
Well, and we'll get there. Ms. Shapiro is so brave and does come back later, much later. But, you know, at the time she's a child and—
Oh my God, of course.
Also, you know, don't you think too at that, I don't know, you wouldn't know, but if it were me, I might think, is this a one-off? Like, you don't know that this is a serial killer. You know, like, we only know now.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe you just didn't think this was going to happen over and over. Would that have changed your mind if you knew that? I don't know. Anyway, so Alcala was paroled after 17 months in 1974 under the indeterminate sentencing program, popular at the time, which allowed parole boards to release offenders as soon as they demonstrated evidence of rehabilitation. Less than 2 months after his release, he was rearrested for assaulting a 13-year-old girl identified in court records as Julie J, who had accepted what she thought would be a ride to school. Once again, he was paroled after serving 2 years of an indeterminate sentence. Yeah.
Wow.
2 years.
I mean, also, that is not Julie James, I don't think. Do you know what I'm saying?
No.
We have to ask her.
So I just wanted to say that. But now it takes us to 1977 after Alcala's second release. So his Los Angeles parole officer took the unusual step of permitting this repeat offender, by the way, in a complete flight risk, to travel to New York City. Now, the NYPD cold case investigators believe that a week after arriving in Manhattan, Alcala killed Ellen Jane Hover, 23 years old, daughter of the owner of the popular Hollywood nightclub, Ciro's, and goddaughter of Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. Her remains were found buried on the grounds of the Rockefeller Estate in Westchester County. Now we get to 1978, where Alcala worked for a short time at the Los Angeles Times as a typesetter and was interviewed by members of the Hillside Strangler Task Force as part of their investigation of known sex offenders. This is all very like Catch Me If You Can, you know, when they bring him in, you know, after arresting him for writing all of these checks that are forged. And now he's like talking to them about all the other people who are forging checks. This is just like, Let me just talk to you, sir, who is a serial killer at this point, about the Hillside Strangler. This makes no sense to me. But although Alcala was ruled out as the Hillside Strangler, he was arrested and served a brief sentence for marijuana possession. And during this particular period, Alcala convinced hundreds of young men and women that he was a professional fashion photographer and photographed them for his portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the three of us know a lot of photographers. I don't find any of them have become murderers.
I'm offended that I've never been asked to be photographed nude now after listening to so many true crime podcasts. I'm like, how dare you not ask me that? It's really a shame.
Okay. Well, now this is going to, you know, now people know that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But I mean, I'm just saying, I think we know better now, but I'm not sure in the 70s they knew better.
Of course not. So now... Alcala tells everybody he's a professional photographer. That's great for him. He has a portfolio, again, great for him. And a Times coworker later recalled that Alcala shared his photos with his workmates. Quote, "I thought it was weird, but I was young. I didn't know anything," she said. "When I asked why he took the photos, he said, their moms asked him to. I remember the girls were naked," end quote. Quote, "He said he was a professional, so in my mind, I was being a model for him," said a woman who allowed Alcala to photograph her in 1979. The portfolio also included, quote, "spread after spread of teenage boys," she said. Now, most of the photos are sexually explicit and most still remain unidentified. Police feared that some of the subjects may be additional cold case victims. Now, in 1979, according to later trial testimony, Alcala knocked unconscious and raped 15-year-old Monique Hoyt while she was posing for photographs. Okay, strap yourselves in. Everybody's strapped in on the roller coaster ride?
We're strapped. Dr. Wolf.
Strapped.
Dr. Wolf, are you strapped in?
Buckled.
Oh, she's buckled. Okay. This is the most bizarre thing that we've ever heard, but it could also actually be my life. So in 1978, Alcala was a contestant on the popular game show, as Dr. Wolf said, The Dating Game. Now, host Jim Lang introduced him as a, quote, successful photographer who got his start when his father found him in the darkroom at the age of 13, fully developed. Between takes, you might find him skydiving or motorcycling. A fellow Bachelor contestant later described Alcala as a, quote, very strange guy with bizarre opinions. Now here's the kicker. Alcala won the competition and a date with Bachelorette Cheryl Bradshaw. Now, Jen, I think we have a clip. Here we go.
Bachelor number one, I am serving you for dinner. Oh. What are you called and what do you look like?
I'm called the banana and I look really good.
Can you be a little more descriptive?
Peel me.
Now that we are sufficiently creeped out at this point, Cheryl, the bachelorette, she subsequently refused to go out with him because she found him creepy. Wonder why you think that, Cheryl? I mean, narcissist Rodriguez. That's why I would find him creepy. Now, after she says, no, you're creepy, right? We've got a criminal profiler named Pat Brown stepping onto this scene right here to tell us that Alcala killed at least three women after the dating game experience and speculated that the rejection from Cheryl might have been the exacerbating factor in these murders. Quote, one wonders what that did in his mind, Brown said. That is something he would not take too well. Serial killers don't understand the rejection. They think that something is wrong with that girl. Quote, she played me. She played hard to get. This is why dating is not my thing. You know what I mean? This is why, like, I go, you know, you go on the apps and you're like, oh, hey, Robert, you seem fun. I'm going to reject you / I guess I better get my knife out.
Oh. You guys can't. Again, we say this, you can't see. So Vosk is drinking something out of a straw.
I think we know what it is. It's cold brew.
It's cold brew. But she's like, what was that? I don't know. The last word she said, this is why I can't, period. And then sip. It was perfect.
Major
it was
just you comedic buttoned timing the joke. Sip.
It was beautiful.
Thank you.
It reminds me of, have you guys done yet The Golden State Killer, another California favorite?
No. She, you know why? I'm sorry, Betsy. I texted her last night saying,
oh, yeah.
I said, I'm glad we're doing this with Betsy, but we should have done The Golden State Killer because she's from Visalia.
Oh, don't even get me started on the
which
Visalia
is where it
Ransacker.
Started.
It was a block away from my house.
We have a request. Would you come back? Would you come back to do it?
I can come back. I can even tell you that I know someone who gave the 23andMe?
Yes.
We know how he was caught. Ultimately, it's so creepy. It's the same thing with the Golden State Killer. I mean, and all these killers, they're rejected. He was rejected by his fiance, and their revenge then killings. I mean, it's sick and obviously super scary, but I remember thinking like, whew, what is Cheryl? That day saved her life. That gut instinct, like 60 seconds backstage saved her life.
We had a request for Alex Brightman to come back. We've had some requests and I think, Jessica, is it okay to say that Kristen Chenoweth might be coming back? Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I think that's very nice.
Right? So, Betsy, thank you for agreeing to come back because you're from there. We've got to do that with you.
Killing It on Broadway is proud to support A-STEP, artists striving to end poverty. This organization was started by our friend Mary Mitchell Campbell, musical director of Broadway and beyond, who also wrote our theme song,
As we all know, the arts are in a challenging time right now in the U.S., and A-STEP has been doing innovative things during this pandemic, including feeding thousands of families, as well as bringing the arts to children. If you are able, please go to astep.org to make a contribution to the Arts Resilience Fund so they can keep killing it by bringing smiles to the faces of children everywhere.
That's astep.org. Thanks, killers.
Now, let's move on. Here we are. It's 1979. Robin Samso, a 12-year-old girl from Huntington Beach, disappeared somewhere between the beach and her ballet class on June 20th, 1979. Her remains were found 12 days later in the Los Angeles foothills. Samso's friends told police that a stranger had approached them on the beach asking to take their pictures. Detectives circulated a sketch of the photographer, and Alcala's parole officer recognized him. During a search of Alcala's mother's house in Monterey Park, police found a rental receipt for a storage locker in Seattle. In the locker, they found Samso's earrings.
Uh-uh.
Alcala, yeah, I know, they got around, mm-hmm. these guys. So Alcala was arrested in July 1979 and held without bail. In 1980, he was tried, convicted, and sentenced to death for Samso's murder. But the verdict was overturned by the California Supreme Court because jurors had been improperly informed of his prior sex crimes. In 1986, after a second trial, virtually identical to the first, except for omission of the prior criminal record testimony, he was again convicted and sentenced to death. A Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals panel nullified the second conviction, in part because a witness was not allowed to support Alcala's contention that the park ranger who found Samso's body had been hypnotized by police investigators.
I hate everybody. Do you know what I mean?
Do you hate Dr. Wolf and Dr. Samard?
Never. I'm saying I hate everybody, okay. Included. And, like, I hate everybody, and by everybody, I mean Alcala. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. Release. Yeah. You got it. Lay your hate on us. We got you. So, fast forward to 2003 and hashtag bless DNA, as we say here on the KOB, mm-hmm. while yes. preparing their third prosecution, count them, three. In 2003, Orange County, California investigators learned that Alcala's DNA sampled under a new state law over his objections matched semen left at the rape murder scenes of two women in Los Angeles. Additional evidence, including another cold case DNA match in 2004, led to Alcala's indictment of the murders of four additional women. Jill Barcombe, 18, a New York runaway found in a Los Angeles ravine in 1977 and originally thought to have been a victim of the Hillside Strangler. Georgia Wixted, 27, bludgeoned in her Malibu apartment in 1977. Charlotte Lamb, 31, found in the laundry room of an El Segundo apartment complex in 1978, and Jill Parenteau, 21, killed in her Burbank apartment in 1979. All of the bodies were found in carefully chosen positions. Another pair of earrings found in Alcala's Seattle storage locker had residue that matched Lamb's DNA. During his incarceration between the second and third trials, Alcala wrote and self-published a book, You the Jury, in which he claimed innocence in the Samso case and suggested a different suspect, Betsy Wolf.
Of course he did.
He also filed two lawsuits against the California penal system for a slip and fall incident and for refusing to provide him a low-fat diet.
Okay, vegan yeah. insurrectionist.
Yeah.
I love how even after all that's proven, it's like, you're not going to blame me. Gosh.
Oh, yeah.
I'm still not wrong. It's crazy.
What is up with these dudes that are like, I may have done some bad shit, but I deserve to be treated with the utmost respect. Mm-hmm. I want my mm-hmm. diet to be different. Like, I got no, that's why I said Mr. Vegan Insurrectionist, what's his face from January 6th,
that's
hashtag 2021, who was like, yeah. I need a vegan diet. And the prison was like, okay, I'm sorry. You broke into the Capitol. Anyway, I'm moving on. Now, you've heard us here at the KIOB describe how there were a couple of trials, because until this point, Alcala got off on technicalities. So here we are on what amounts to his third or joined trial. This is in 2003. Prosecutors enter a motion to join the Samso charges with those of the four newly discovered victims. Now, Alcala's attorney contested it, as one of them explained, quote, if you're a juror and you hear one murder case, you may be able to have reasonable doubt. But it's very hard to say you have reasonable doubt on all five, especially when four of the five aren't alleged by eyewitnesses, but are proven by DNA matches, end quote. Now, in 2006, the California Supreme Court ruled in the prosecution's favor of duh. And in February 2010, Alcala stood trial on the five joined charges. For the third trial, Alcala elected to act as his own attorney. We love when they do this. We love when they do this.
Because no one else can do it better, right?
It's like what Betsy said earlier about, like, I couldn't possibly, I'm not guilty, you
classic
guys.
Narcissist. Yes.
Jokes. jokes on jokes, but I love when they do this. I love when they're like, I have to be my own attorney because I just know. So he acts as his own attorney. And it, as we know here, and all of our listeners here at the KIOB understand, it always goes so well when they do that. And he took the stand in his own defense. Now, what do they always tell you if you're a defense lawyer? Don't put your defense
client, your client
on the stand. Don't do it. It's not going to go well. But he took the stand, and for 5 hours, he played the roles of both interrogator and witness. Now, I think we all know here, and the three of us can all be included in this, is that I wanted to say hello to Warren Late and say hi to Dick Wolf and with the Law and Order SVU moment, like, hey, Dick gang, because I could do that. I could probably do all the characters in my one area. So I'm available, and I know that you're available and I'm available. And he asked himself questions. Alcala did this, and he referred to himself as Mr. Alcala in a deeper than normal voice and then answering himself. So it'd be sort of like this: Mr. Alcala, did you do it? No, Attorney Alcala, I did.
Interesting. He chose the higher innocent voice. Okay. I see where you're going with that.
No, I didn't.
And the Emmy goes to Dr. Voss.
Now, this is a bizarre self-questioning and answering session, which I will do after this podcast ends today. I feel as though I could possibly do that whilst I shower. And he told jurors, often in a rambling monotone, that he was at Knott's Berry Farm, as we all were, applying for a job as a photographer at the time Sam So was kidnapped. And he showed the jury a portion of his 1978 appearance on The Dating Game, naturally, because he wanted to prove that the earrings found in his Seattle locker were his, not Sam So's. Now, Jed Mills, the actor who competed against Alcala on the show, told a reporter that the earrings were not yet a socially acceptable accoutrement for men in 1978. Fast forward to the fact that I think I was a drag queen in a past life, so I find them to be socially acceptable any day on a man. Now, quote, "I've never seen a man with an earring in his ear," he said. "I would have noticed them on him." So Alcala makes no significant attempt to dispute the four added charges, other than to assert that he could not remember killing any of the women.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense, right, Betsy?
Yeah. Yeah. I often forget things like that conveniently when I'm on trial.
I think you've probably forgotten a couple of murders, right?
Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, in the suburbs, they blend. It blends.
We don't have to talk about that today, Jess.
Okay, I love you. Now, as part of his closing argument, he played the Arlo Guthrie song Alice's Restaurant, in which the protagonist tells a psychiatrist he wants to kill. After less than 2 days deliberation, what do we think the jury did? Yes, the jury convicted him on all 5 counts of first degree murder. And it probably had something to do with the song. Again, I don't recommend as a lawyer that my client play that song, but bygones are be bygones. Hindsight's 2020. Now, remember Tali Shapiro, who was our brave first victim? She was actually a surprise witness during the penalty phase of the trial, which is amazing. And Richard Rappaport, a psychiatrist paid by Alcala and the only defense witness, testified that borderline personality disorder could explain Alcala's claims that he had no memory of committing the murders. The prosecutor argued that Alcala was a sexual predator who, quote, knew what he was doing was wrong and didn't care. Now, in March 2010, Alcala was sentenced to death for a not first, not second, but third time.
Well, let's tie up some loose ends, first of which are these unidentified photographs. In March 2010, the Huntington Beach, California, and New York City police departments released 120 of Alcala's photographs and sought the public's help in identifying them in the hope of determining if any of the women and children he photographed were additional victims. Approximately 900 additional photos could not be made public, police said, because they were too sexually explicit. In the first few weeks, police reported that approximately 21 women had come forward to identify themselves, and at least 6 families said they believed they recognized loved ones who disappeared years ago and were never found. None of the photos was unequivocally connected to a missing person case or unsolved murder until 2013, when a family member recognized the photo of Christine Thornton, 28, whose body was found in Wyoming in 1982. 109 of the original photos remain posted online, and police continue to solicit the public's help with further identifications. After his 2010 conviction, New York authorities announced that they would no longer pursue Alcala because of his status as a convict awaiting execution. Nevertheless, in January 2011, a Manhattan grand jury indicted him for the murders of Cornelia Crilly, the TWA flight attendant, and Ellen Hoover, the Ciro's heiress, in 1971 and 1977, respectively. In June 2012, he was extradited to New York, where he initially entered not guilty pleas on both counts. In December 2012, he changed both pleas to guilty, citing a desire to return to California to pursue appeals of his death penalty conviction. On January 7th, 2013, a Manhattan judge sentenced Alcala to an additional 25 years to life. The death penalty has not been an option in New York State since 2007. In 2010, Seattle police named Alcala as a person of interest in the unsolved murders of Antoinette Whitaker, 13, in July 1977, and Joyce Gaunt, 17, in February 1978. Alcala rented the Seattle area storage locker, in which investigators later found jewelry belonging to two of his California victims in 1979. Other cold cases were reportedly targeted for reinvestigation in California, New York, New Hampshire, and Arizona. In March 2011, investigators in Marin County, California, north of San Francisco, announced that they were confident that Alcala was responsible for the 1977 murder of 19-year-old Pamela Jean Lampson, who disappeared after making a trip to Fisherman's Wharf to meet a man who had offered to photograph her. Her remains were subsequently found in Marin County near a hiking trail. With no fingerprints or usable DNA, charges are unlikely to be filed, but police claimed that there is sufficient evidence to convince them that Alcala committed the crime. In September 2016, Alcala was charged with the murder of 28-year-old Christine Ruth Thornton, who disappeared in 1977. In 2013, a relative recognized her as the subject of one of Alcala's photos made public by Huntington Beach PD and NYPD. Her body was found in Sweetwater County, Wyoming in 1982, which we mentioned before, but was not identified until 2015, which is like 5 seconds ago, you guys, when DNA supplied by Thornton's relatives matched tissue samples from her remains. Hashtag bless DNA.
Everyone, ladies, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I have to
DNA.
Say this.
Mm-hmm.
This is not on video, but Betsy just snapped us. She just did a Z. Like, she just gave us a Z snap, which is like
DNA.
Hey, girl, hey.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all those years to finally get some justice. Thank God. And here we are rounding third, you guys. Alcala admitted taking the photograph, but not to killing the woman. Nobody believes you, Rodney. This woman was approximately 6 months pregnant at the time of her death. It's just horrible. Thornton is the first alleged murder victim linked to the Alcala photos made public in 2010. The 73-year-old Alcala was reportedly too ill to make the journey from California to Wyoming to stand trial on the new charges. He remains in California State Prison. And my girlfriends, that is the story of the dating game killer, Rodney Alcala.
He is still alive.
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder if he's with Joseph D'Angelo. Are they in the same prison? Do we know? Is the Golden State Killer? Do we know? Is there like one prison in California? I need to do my research on.
No, I mean, we have California
State
Prison.
Are they all at San Quentin?
We have San Quentin, which is, you know, where our Scott Petersons are and what's his face? Richard Ramirez was. Of course, we have Alcatraz where all the ghosts are. But I'm always intrigued. All of these years later, Betsy, you said in the beginning, what's happening in your brain? Because there are obviously many more murders than we know. I'm still convinced that there are many more murders that he committed that have not been solved.
I mean, if they've proven it's like, what, 15, you've got to believe that if they have like 900 creepy photos of women, that there are so many more. And just like, and there's DNA. This is the creepiest thing to me. There is DNA sitting in all these police stations across, you know, the United States, wherever, elsewhere, that's just waiting to kind of be connected. And thank God now we have like a computer, you know, the ability to actually be able to do it. Because only then did we really start like realizing, oh, these are connected. These people didn't like stop killing. They just moved somewhere else. They moved somewhere else. And now we have that database, which is, you know, why the 70s can't be repeated again, which is a good thing for, you know, serial killers or wannabe serial killers.
And to answer your question, Dr. Wolf, Joseph D'Angelo, the Golden State Killer, is in the North Kern State Prison. And Rodney Alcala is in Corcoran, prison in Corcoran.
Just a lot of prisons there.
They've spread them all out.
A lot of Corcoran.
They have spread them all out.
they've really, I mean, you know, California's a big state, I get it, but there is something, especially, again, talking about the psychology in the brain, where, you know, it's not that these men are not smart. I actually find them to be quite smart. Because they have, you know, these abilities to manipulate and to really dig into like emotional quadrants of people, young women, young.
Compartmentalize.
Yes. So there's something that's super scary about that to me, because I like to think I've listened to so much true crime and I know Betsy, you haven't, obviously, Jen. Hello, that's why we're here. But we've listened to so much true crime that you kind of start to understand and see patterns in all of these killers. And obviously, most of the ones that we have covered are men who have some significant trauma associated with women. And it is not lost on me that these men who we have covered in our stories have murdered so many people, just going place to place to place to place. And at some point were caught. But my God, it took a long time. And they didn't even, again, for the Fisherman's Wharf case, for him to be like, I absolutely took her photo, but I definitely didn't murder her. Bro, yes, you did.
Which is so bizarre, because it seems like in Alcala's case, he loved the notoriety. I mean, this is a man who went on a dating show and almost like was begging to be in a certain way, like recognized, you know, like loved.
You're so right.
Loved like the ploy of charming. I mean, they talk about like how much he loved the moments before when he was like, I'm just going to be the charming, really nice guy until I'm not. But like the power that he found in those moments, like right before. It just shows I think he enjoyed it so much. And there's so many that like never want to be caught and just kind of are hiding out. And like, it's like this kind of secretive thing, but he almost was like so brazen.
As they said earlier, the experts say he had narcissistic personality disorder, and that would
malignant.
Be in keeping everything. Yeah. Malignant narcissism. And that would be in keeping with everything the two of yous just said.
This is a deep one. I mean, this guy's one of the worst. Mm-hmm. This is one of the top 10. So
do you consider this one of the top 10, Betsy? Yeah.
Well, yeah. What I think fascinating so about this one is, yeah, I mean, this guy was all over and in and out of the justice system. This man was arrested multiple times. This isn't like the Golden State Killer where we just didn't know who he was. This guy was in and out constantly, served times. The fact that like he just kept doing that just baffles me, you know?
Oh, yeah.
We cannot thank you enough for being here. Betsy Wolf, we love you. Am I correct, Miss Dr. Vosk? We love her.
Oh, we're obsessed with Betsy.
And I love that you're doing this. Are you kidding me? Little did I know that when I witnessed a crime, a purse snatching at the mall, and then followed the man and took down his license plate, that it would lead me to someday being on Killing It on Broadway podcast and get to live out my like true crime obsessions. Little did I know.
Well, Betsy gives us that little gem at the end of our episode where we're like, why did you get into true crime? And now she's decided to bookend
us. Now you
know.
And here's the teaser, y'all. She's coming back. We got her on tape. She's coming back to do the Golden State Killer.
You're going to get right? Jen Samara. I've got him just sizzle. For you.
Again, thank you for joining us and taking the time to join us. You are a dream. Now go get out of here and live your best life.
Love you. Bye.
Bye.
Ladies and gents and friends of all ages, we love Betsy. She is a gem. She joined us today out of the kindness of her heart and her love of true crime, which reminds us how much we love you, our near and dear crime fam. Thank you so much for listening. And until next time, keep killing it.
Don't kill anyone.
Killers, go to our Patreon page and join us to get exclusive bonus content. And follow us on Instagram at Killing It on Broadway and Twitter at Killing It on B-Way.
Subscribe to us for free wherever you download your podcasts.
And go ahead and give us a 5-star rating and lovely review. It'll be good for you.
Killing It on Broadway is a production of Killing It on Broadway, LLC.
Music by Mary Mitchell Campbell. Orchestrations, Benedict Braxton Smith.
Edited and engineered by Smokey.
Morale officers, Fred and Nelson. Say goodbye, Fred.
Say goodbye, Nelson.